The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, my time-travelling friends. Welcome back to this final part of a three-part series commemorating the Battle of Bosworth Field, which took place on the 22nd of August, 1485. I hope you've enjoyed the journey so far. And in this final part, we consider the aftermath of the battle. And in doing so, we return to the city of Leicester to meet up again with Steve Bruce, who's going to talk to us about what happened to Richard's body when he was brought back to the city by the victorious Henry VII. Okay, well, I'm not going to tarry any longer. Let's go straight back over and pick up our adventure in time. Well, dear listeners, I hope you enjoyed our time exploring the battlefield at Bosworth. Now, of course, we have come back with Richard's body back to the city of Leicester. This time, it is accompanied by the triumphant new king, Henry VII. And we're here again with Steve. Steve, thank you for joining us once again.
That's okay. Welcome back.
To help us to close out this story, which is all about what happened in the aftermath of the battle. We now have two people really to consider here back in Leicester. We've got Richard III's dead body, and I'd love to hear about what happened to him. But as I just mentioned, he's now accompanied by the victorious Henry VII. And you've brought me here to have a look at this plaque. And I'll read this out to you, dear listeners. And again, there'll be a picture in the show notes page. And this is to commemorate the occasions 500 years ago when the people of Leicester greeted and honoured two kings of England within 2 days. So Richard III, on his solemn departure from the town on the 21st of August 1485 to do battle for his kingdom, and Henry VII, on his arrival in the evening of the 22nd of August 1485 from his victorious field near Market Bosworth, bringing in his train the body of the vanquished Richard III. Ooh, that's I never thought about it, of course. Two kings in 2 days.
Yes.
That must have been quite something for the people of Leicester.
Yes, I'm not sure that they actually greeted Henry VII or Henry Tudor. I think he was more intent on getting down to London as quickly as he could and staking his claim to the crown, so that everybody knew that he was the new king and Richard had, as it says on the plaque, been vanquished. But again, this is recognition that we were very much Richard III aware in Leicester, and the city decided to mark the 500th anniversary with this rather splendid plaque.
Yes.
Marked here, yes.
That's fantastic. And maybe we should just give people an idea of where we are. They probably can hear that, having come back into Leicester, we're in a much quieter place. We're obviously next to a beautiful church, and I can see some very old Norman features. So this must be a very old church. And street signs and like Castle Street, etc. So we're clearly back in the old city.
Yes, and we're about to enter the central part of Leicester's medieval castle, which was founded by the Normans shortly after the Norman conquest. And the church that you've just mentioned was part of the original castle buildings, and it's called St Mary de Castro to recognise its situation as a church within a castle.
Ah, I see. Yes, yes, that makes loads of sense. So we're right in sort of the castle complex now, or do we need to...
We're almost.
Almost.
Almost. One archway to go through,
and then
we're there.
I see a beautiful... Well, it looks like a Tudoresque archway now in a timber-framed building. Is this where the original medieval archway?
Well, this is early 15th century, and somewhere around here would have been the north entrance into the castle. Very, very little remains these days of Leicester's once great castle. But we still do have odd bits of evidence here and there that a castle did exist.
Yes.
And even in Richard III's time, it was still playing an important part in the administration of the town of Leicester.
Right, I see. OK, let's go on. So we're passing underneath this timber-framed Tudor arch gatehouse. Well, it's actually built into a house now, isn't it?
Yes, it's been, for most of its time, it's been a dwelling. It's known locally as John of Gaunt's Cottage. But don't run away with the thought that he ever lived here, because it was actually built after he was dead.
Yes, I can see that. Right, you might be able to hear a little bit of crinkling, because it's just started to rain, and I've just put my hood up on my raincoat. So we're in a courtyard. I guess
This was the centre point of the castle, yes. Through the trees in front of us, you can see there's a slight raise in the ground, which is where the castle mound, the first part of the castle, still stands, even though it's a little shorter than it was at one time. The Victorians took 15 foot off the top so they could build a bowling green. And the building, the brick-fronted building in front of us, is the Great Hall of the castle, which was built by one of those Norman Earls of Leicester. The building is credited with the date of 1150.
Oh, so it's actually inside, behind that
facade? It's behind
facade.
That, yes. The reason the facade was built was essentially to stop the whole lot falling down at the end of the 17th century.
Oh, how interesting.
But we can still see within the building examples of the original Norman stonework and timber work.
Can we see it, or is this?
I'm afraid not. No, it's part of De Montfort University now.
I see.
And they use it as a working building.
I see.
Actually, the answer to your question is I might be able to talk my way in, and it's very interesting, but it doesn't have any particular Richard connections.
OK, well, let's not, because we're short on time.
We're strapped for time, yeah. I'd love to show you.
Yeah.
I can show you what it looks like inside on one of the boards,
okay,
just for your information.
And while we're passing the church now, it's on my left-hand side, lovely sawtooth Norman design on some of the windows, some later Gothic windows. Is anybody of importance buried in there?
Well, I'm sure some of them would like to think they're of importance.
Okay. But
they are local businessmen who would have lived in this area at a time when it was a suburban area for domestic dwellings. So a very important church in its time. But originally it was the church of the castle, and therefore it was a place of fairly high status. Originally a collegiate church,
yes,
built for the Beaumont family, the Norman Beaumont family, but attended by, over the period of 200 or 300 years, by many kings of England.
Well, that's why I was wondering whether some of those early Lancastrians were buried in there, but no.
As far as the Lancastrians were concerned, next door was a far more important place where a college was set up dedicated to the life and death and afterlife of the Lancastrians.
And what was the name of that place, just for people who might be interested in
looking
up? That's
called the Newark.
The Newark?
Yes, and it's called the Newark because it was started in 1331 by Henry, Earl of Leicester and Earl of Lancaster. It was adjacent to the old work of the castle. Leicester people called it Henry's New Work, and over time, New Work became
Newark.
Newark. Oh,
perfect, I love it. Love that.
This is what the... And that's what the Great Hall used to look like.
So again, we're in front of one of the notice boards. There's a lovely set of notice boards, actually, just guiding you around the city. So we've got a picture of the old hall, and I guess the bits of architecture that still survive today.
Yes, and this is this courtroom setup is still actually in place. It's not used as a courtroom these days, but the reason that the whole building is still with us is because from about 1820, it was used daily as a courtroom all the way up till 1992.
Yeah.
But you can still see the two Norman windows and the Norman stonework on the more modern photograph, which match the depiction that you've got on the much older drawing,
yes,
next to it.
And I noticed that
there were, I'm just going to read a little bit of this, about during Richard III's time. This ball says they would probably have visited the castle on a number of occasions. It was an important estate office for the Duchy of Lancaster and Leicestershire's estates, a place for holding courts of assize, and the criminal courts would have heard more serious cases. So there is a postulation that Richard, along with some other kings I see here, Edward I, Edward II, Henry IV, probably all visited.
I think we can take it a stage further than that, because there's very good documentary evidence, and one that's frequently quoted in King Richard's case is a document where at the bottom he has signed it, "From my castle in Leicester."
Oh, well, right. OK, well, that sorts that out, yes. Then. I love that kind of definitive proof. Now, a bit further on down a street called Castle View, I can see a beautiful old gateway. So is this the gateway that you were perhaps referring to?
This is the gateway. This dates from the very early 1400s, and it was an additional gateway that was put in to join the castle area and the area of the Newark, where the Lancastrian religious college had been set up some years earlier. And I guess it gave an easy way through between when people were travelling from one to the other. Suffered a lot of damage. This is the point where later in history, Leicester was attacked during the Civil War.
Oh, I see.
So you get far more than Richard III for your money when you have a look around old Leicester.
I must admit, just here, we're on a cobbled street. There's lots of ancient architecture around. You suddenly feel like you're in a different city than the one that we were in when we were telling the beginning of the story.
Yes, absolutely.
And there really is this ancient heart, and it's peaceful and it's quiet, and it's the place where you can imagine, you know, entourages of nobles progressing to the Newark pageantry. A colour, it's very, yeah. Your imagination can start to take a grip in a place like this, I think.
Yes, I think so, yes. A lot of it is not necessarily as it was hundreds of years ago, but nevertheless, it still has a very old feel to it. And as you've pointed out, it's very quiet down here. And it doesn't take too much thinking about to take yourself back to those far-off days.
I just can't believe that I lived in Leicester for...
Shame on you.
8 years or so, and I never came here.
Well, for what it's worth, many people live in Leicester for a lot longer than that.
And never make it up here. I had no idea. Oh, you see, history is around every corner. If you just look...
Yes,
and even if it's only a fragment, And somehow it becomes a portal to the past, and then you can let your imagination run wild.
Well, it's interesting that you should mention fragments, because I have a very small fragment to show you on the next part of the journey of King Richard.
All right, well, I'm up for fragments. People who follow me will know that a field with some earthworks in it or just a little bit of stone is enough to get my juices flowing. You see, I love this. Look at this little, this doorway. It's a tiny little doorway.
You've got a fireplace up there.
Yeah.
And a doorway where you can see the wall behind it. Is it a diagonal?
Yes.
That's the spiral staircase coming down.
Down, yeah.
Now, this is made of local stone, as a lot of the buildings were. And one of the reasons why much of the castle disappeared was because the local sandstone is very soft.
Yes, it's very worn, isn't it? In fact, I'm touching it and it's sort of just...
Don't rub too hard. I made that mistake.
The gate will come down.
And you can see in lots of places where more modern stone, more resistant stone has been put in to restore the place and keep all the old bits together.
And I guess the ground level must have come up because that little doorway...
Yes.
Even at 5 foot three, you can't quite get through it, so I imagine probably...
Yeah, there could well have been a raise there. Yeah. And if you look very carefully, you can see the groove when they used to drop the portcullis down.
Oh, yes, I can see that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So it's all there here. You just have to know where to look for it.
You certainly do. I can see another old-looking building here on the left. What's that, Steve?
Yes, this is called Wigston's House. It was built by a man called William Wigston, who was a Leicester wool merchant, very rich man. Dates to around 1511, which was the last few years of the existence of the Newark before Henry VIII and his son Edward did away with all of the monasteries and establishments of this kind.
I see.
So even at the time of 1511, the area was still carrying out its religious function, and indeed the house itself is called the Chantry House because that's where Wigston installed a couple of chantry priests to pray and say masses for himself and his family.
I see. So the Newark, as you say, it's gone, but was it once beneath where that house?
No, it was here. It was everywhere here, yes. This building is the chapel of the 1331 hospital that Henry, Duke of Lancaster, built. His son, also called Henry, Henry of Gromont, you've heard of him?
Yeah.
Well, he carried on his father's work. He was the guy who had an upgrade in title from Earl of Lancaster to Duke of Lancaster. So he was Duke of Lancaster and Earl of Leicester at the same time. And he was the one who founded the religious establishment here.
I see.
And in front of us, at what was subsequently became part of De Montfort University, this is where the centrepiece, the glorious church of the Annunciation of Our Lady, was built to support the whole area. And this is the one, there are no pictures of it whatsoever, no pictures survive. And we know that virtually after the Reformation, by the end of the 16th century, there was nothing there to see. But remarkably, deep down in the vaults, two tiny features have been preserved. And that's the only thing that we can look at on the church where there's a strong belief that Richard's body was displayed when he came back from Bosworth.
Ah, I see. Yeah. So can we just talk about that? Can you remind us, obviously we've heard at Bosworth how his body was slung over a horse, naked.
Yes.
Potentially some rather despicable things were done to it. And so he was brought back here, displayed for how long and why?
I think the reason for the display was probably to confirm that he was actually no more, that he had been killed, because of course there was no newspapers or press or anything like that in those days. The only way you could demonstrate that you were telling the truth was so that people saw it. And the answer to the second question is just 2 days. Which could have something to do with the fact that it was middle of summer. And you wouldn't have wanted a dead body to be around for too much longer.
No. So very quick decisions were made about where to inter him. Do we have any idea why he was interred ultimately at Greyfriars and
not
here? No,
the last part of the journey from here to Greyfriars is a little bit of a mystery. Whether the friars came across and said, look, this man needs a proper burial. I suspect that he wouldn't have wanted to have been buried in the church here when it was a church, because it was so much associated with the House of Lancaster.
Right, yes.
Or on the other hand, they could have just thought, well, OK, 2 days is enough. We'll just take him over there and dump him outside the friary and they can deal with it.
Yeah, because I suppose if it was such an important site for the Lancastrians, they wouldn't want a Yorkist king buried there. They probably would have wanted him buried somewhere of less status, less importance.
Even though it has to be said that when he came to the throne, Richard still did support the establishment that was here. Because, of course, by that time, the Duchy of Lancaster had become incorporated into the crown.
Yes, of course it had. So I'm imagining the final place we need to go is the site of Greyfriars and
talk about the tiny bit of the old church here that still remains. The two arches that you can see on the picture actually date from the original church, and it's quite possible that they might have been part of the crypt where Richard was put on display for those 2 days, although we can't be absolutely certain of that. The reason that they've survived is because future buildings, after the church was demolished on the site, actually incorporated those arches into their foundations, and they were rediscovered, I think it was around about the 1930s, when the building that you can now see was extended, and the cottages on that site were demolished, and lo and behold, there in among their foundations were two medieval church arches. The chances of that are quite incredible. Almost a romantic story.
Yeah, well, still, we've got something, a fragment.
Yes, it's only a fragment, but we've got it. Yes. Yes. The big archway that we're approaching dates from about 1410, and it's not, as many people think, a town gateway. It was purely an entrance gateway into the Newark religious area.
I see, yes.
The reason it's built as big as it is really, it's a statement, in a sense, by the Lancastrians of how important they were, or how important they thought they were, depending on your viewpoint. But it's purely there for show.
Let's go and have a look.
Yes.
Because I have driven past this gazillions of times, and never really questioned what it was. And now I'm seeing it with completely, completely new eyes. So we have a huge gateway here with a kind of a turret to the side. It's a big block, isn't it? It's a gateway block. And it's called the Newark Gateway. Right, okay. So is this ever open for people to get into?
Yes, it is. We were open on Sunday, and I was conducting a tour around the gateway, so we can get inside it and give people conducted tours. Not all that frequently, but certainly on the last Sunday of the month in the summertime, and on other occasions like Heritage Open Days.
Yeah.
So you can really absorb some of Leicester's history.
Yeah.
And like so many things, it's the fact that the building's been used over the years for different purposes that have caused it to still be here now.
Yes, yes, it gets repurposed, doesn't it? I can
Absolutely,
see some lovely
yes.
faces, carved faces.
Yes.
It looks very Henry VII over in that corner. I'm not saying it is by any stretch, but...
No, I don't think any of the carved figures represent any individuals.
Yeah.
But I think it's just the stonemasons like to have a little bit of a fun,
yes.
didn't they? And
sometimes
it was an
themselves.
Outlet carved themselves,
yeah.
yes, or someone who looked like Henry VII or whatever.
But I notice here you've got a little reconstruction of
yes.
the newer Kerry. They're always so super helpful, I find.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
So lovely. I can
yes.
see the gateway
yep,
where we
this
are.
This is where we are now. That is the church of St Mary of the Annunciation.
Yeah.
This is the gateway that we came through between the castle and the Newark.
Yes.
And here, with its once splendid spire, is the church of the castle, St Mary de Castro.
That we walked by.
Yes.
So and that's the hospital area.
And that's
that
the hospital, absolutely, yes.
I see, yes. Yeah. So it's a religious monastic compound, essentially. Is that right or not?
Yeah, well, it wasn't quite monastic.
No.
That indicates that it might have been a monastery,
but it was
which it wasn't, but it was a collegiate setup, yes. Yes.
Marvellous. So I guess if it's correct that Richard was in the church over there, then his body must have been brought through this gateway on its way to Greyfriars?
Almost certainly, yes. Yes. It could have gone the other way around.
Yeah. It's quite a thought, though.
We can only conjecture on that, yes.
It's quite a thought, though.
Yes.
So, Steve, are we heading back towards where we started now?
Yes, we are. We're going to... I'm not quite sure that we're actually retracing Richard's journey, literally, but we are making that, well, what turned out to be the last but one journey for his remains,
yes.
to the place where they were buried for over 500 years, and that is the Greyfriars Priory in Leicester. So that's where we're heading now.
Let's go.
Miserere.
across the street here was occupied by the Grey Friars. And the little street we're going down now, New Street, was, this goes right through the centre of the site and was obviously only constructed after the friary was...
So it's a new street.
Yes, that's why it's called...
It's a new street.
New Street, even though it's old.
Amazing, yeah. So I guess like most medieval cities, there were a number of religious institutions. And how many were there in...
Well, we had three separate priories, the Black Friars, the White Friars and the Grey Friars. Mm. And then, of course, we had a series of religious guilds as well, the Merchants' Guilds in Leicester as well. And I guess in those sorts of terms, it was very much like most medieval towns.
And the friars were the ones that used to kind of mingle with the rest of the lay people. It was their... They weren't the
yes,
kind of reclusive some,
no,
monastic,
no.
They yeah. were there to spread
some,
the word.
Some more than others. Augustinians were particularly known for being among the population.
Okay.
Here we are at the back door, as it were.
Yeah, so tell us where we are. I can see in front of me the spire of the cathedral in front of me here. Tell us exactly where we are now.
Well, we're in New Street and we're possibly very close, if not actually... on part of the site where the Friar's Church would have stood back in medieval times. And it was knowing the pattern, the standard pattern of the medieval friaries and where they usually put their churches that was a significant help in actually finding the king's remains. So the king was buried in part of the church that would have been appropriate to his status in the choir, and therefore it was possible to target, I think, to some extent, the excavations to give the archaeologists the finest chance, the best chance that they had of actually finding the remains.
So there must be, remind me, there must have been plans of the Grey Friars.
Well, there weren't so much plans, but there are pictures that have been done by people cleverer than me, where the site of the church has been superimposed onto the modern street street system.
But you were saying before that people just know because often these monastic institutions had a particular layout to them, and therefore
yes.
there was a good guess about exactly where the church would have been.
Yes,
I mean that was. And it's incredible, really, wasn't it? So we're standing opposite
the... it's still a remarkable story, yes, whichever way you look at it.
Philippa Langley did an amazing job in doing the research behind this. And we're standing in front of the car park. Probably
yes.
one of the most famous car parks in the whole world, particularly if you're
yes.
interested in history.
Yes.
The King Richard III Centre is beyond, and obviously the part of the car park where Richard has found... You can now actually look down and see his grave. And I think we're going to go and do that in a minute and maybe just talk a little bit about
yes.
what was found there. Would that be a good thing
yes,
to do?
Yes, I think that would be a good way to finish.
To end,
yes.
yeah.
Yes.
Well, why not? So we're just going to continue walking down New Street. We're walking towards the cathedral now. And it sounds like you've got some peregrine falcons nesting up there.
Yes.
Aha, there we go. Oh, yes, and just to my right here, another one of the boards... Just talking about the friary, and again, we've got a little picture reconstruction of what this part of Leicester would have looked like.
Yeah, and this is the south wall of the old town, with the Grey Friars settlement here.
Yeah.
This is the priory conclave just here, and in the centre of that church, that's where Richard was
okay.
buried.
Well, let's go and see the site of yep. the grave and see where it all ended for poor Richard. Although not quite, as we were saying, because, of course, there is an appendix to this story.
There is indeed, yes. Yes. Interesting that the walk that Blue Badge Guides have been doing in Leicester since 1976... the story of Richard III in Leicester.
Yes.
We still tell exactly the same story now. All the detail is there. The only difference is that we do now have that added appendix at the end.
Yeah, absolutely.
None of the rest has changed.
So we're just reapproaching the King Richard III Centre. We've been, walking about, what, 40 minutes, 45 minutes, something like that. So I guess that's the kind of length of the trail. And we've been stopping along the way. So it's quite an easy trail to do. Everything, because as we said,
everything,
the city
everything
was,
follows logically, yes, yeah. Yes. It was one man's journey out and then the same man's journey back in.
And not over quite a concentrated area.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
So we're inside the visitor centre. Do you think we'll be able to get in and have a look at his...
I should think so.
Okay, yes. Lead the way. So if you haven't visited the visitor centre, they've done a fabulous job here of retelling Richard's story and of the battle and of his injuries and of the rediscovery. And the denouement of the visit is to come here into what was once the car park and is now... with this glass floor, which always feels really difficult to walk on, you can literally stand over and look down at the site of his grave. It was quite a shallow grave, wasn't it, if I remember
yes,
rightly?
It was very shallow, yes, and there was no evidence of any clothing on the body at all, not even a shroud, and certainly no evidence of a coffin.
Really?
So all the evidence is of a very hasty burial.
Yeah. And you've got the projection of Richard's skeleton on the ground, so you can even see the layout of his body.
Yeah, as he was found, yes.
As he was found.
Yes.
So at the time, was any kind of tombstone slab commemorating his burial put in place?
Not, I think, immediately at the time, but there is an account that Henry VII did pay for an acknowledgement to be installed, and I think one of the reasons of that possibly was to try and unite the two factions that had created the Wars of the Roses, bring them together to move the country forward as one.
Yes, right, because of course by this time he's married the eldest daughter of Edward IV,
yes.
Richard was her
yes.
uncle,
yeah.
We don't know what she thought about Richard, of course. It'd be lovely
yes,
to know. Wouldn't it be so fascinating to know?
Oh, it's fascinating to know
there was
so much more.
So
yes.
much going yeah. on in that family.
This is why I think it's such a good story, because there's so much that you don't know and so much you can think about and conjecture on.
Yeah. And I also notice, out of interest, you can see some of the old tiles
yes.
that form the floor of the original friary,
yes.
which is kind of cool as well,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, it's not just the one hole in the ground, as it were.
But you see how, when you look at the level of the tiles and you see the depth of the grave, you can see it's like a foot, 2 foot
yeah,
maybe,
2 foot
maximum.
Yeah, 2 foot at most, yes.
So, but it looks quite hard ground, so they must have really had to chisel that out. Wow. Steve, if people want to come on their own tour and have you as their guide, how do they get hold of you?
Well, we do have a Leicester Guides email, and the address is leicesterguides, all lowercase, all one word, @gmail.com.
And do people need to put it for your attention, or will you pick that up?
No, I'll pick it up automatically.
Okay, so I encourage you folks, it's so much better to have somebody with you who knows what they're looking at and can tell you the history. So please do make a point of contacting Steve Bruce to be your guide if you visit Leicester. And then you're not just going to be doing the visitor centre and the cathedral, but you'll get a chance to walk around the old city and learn much more about being, travelling, I should say, in the footsteps of Richard III. Well, I think that probably not quite brings us to the end of the story, because in a moment I'm going to be making my way literally across the road into the cathedral, where we get to pick up the final chapter of Richard's story, which of course was his reburial in Leicester Cathedral. But for now, as this is where you leave us, Steve, I just want to say thank you so much for being our guide around the old city of Leicester.
It's been a pleasure showing you around, Sarah. Thank you.
So we've now, as you can probably hear, dear listeners, come inside Leicester Cathedral, and I'm meeting Rebecca Hale. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being our guide here today. And I wanted to chat with you in a moment about the internment of Richard III, because obviously this is now his final resting place. And actually, we're recording this on a balcony that looks down the nave of the church towards his grave, which I can see over there. And we'll go down and actually have a look in a moment. But before we get on to that, it'd be lovely if you could tell our listeners who you are and what do you do here at Leicester Cathedral.
Yep. As you said, my name's Rebecca Hale. I'm the volunteer manager here. And I've been here since, well, it predates the reinterment of Richard III by actually just a few months. So I came here at a very fortuitous time, because things really started to get rather exciting around that time when I joined in August, September 2014.
I can imagine before Richard was reinterred here, this was probably quite a quiet church in terms of visitor numbers. But today there's a school party here. I suspect things have changed beyond all recognition.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, I mean, in those pre-reinterment days, I started off as a volunteer in actual fact, and I learnt how to be a guide. But I would be on duty on a Monday morning. In those days, very quiet cathedral, be lucky to encounter maybe a dozen, maximum 20 people during a shift. So it changed beyond all recognition. In the immediate aftermath of the reinterment, just exploded the visitor interest, and did plateau off, you know, after a time, but we still get significant interest, and it's a big draw. Yeah. Having a king buried in this small provincial cathedral has really helped us in terms of our visitor numbers.
So the internment itself, how did it come to be here? I know there was some controversy at the time, wasn't there? A bit of a push-pull between Leicester and York. Mm. Can you remind us a little bit about that story? And then maybe we could talk about the internment itself.
Mm. Well, the point of it is that at the time of the dig, and when they initially found some remains, it was incumbent upon the archaeology department at the university to apply for a licence to the Ministry of Justice, because you can't exhume remains unless you have a licence. So when the licence came back, it actually said clearly, and I'm paraphrasing a bit here, but the inference was, if the remains turned out to be Richard's, they would be buried in the nearest consecrated ground, so it was always here. And I remember during the time when there was that legal challenge, so where the Plantagenet Alliance challenged the reburial of Richard in Leicester, I attended a talk at a local church, and the Bishop of Leicester was there. And it was a bit of a question and answer session, and my question was, at the end of the talk, was how confident are you that Richard will be reinterred in Leicester Cathedral? And he said 100%. Now that was right in the centre of the legal challenge. So, you know, I think from, you know, I have had, you know, discussed this with a number of different people via an oral history project. There was a certain sense that the challenge itself was rather spurious, there wasn't much foundation to it, and that ultimately they didn't have a leg to stand on. So no surprise then that the courts found in favour of the reinterment being here, but nonetheless it did delay the reinterment, so it was going to be at by a certain date, and they had to push it back. Fortuitous for me, because had it been on the original date, I wouldn't have been either a volunteer here and I wouldn't have been working here. So
were you actually here on the day of the internment itself?
Well, I was actually here, but I wasn't actually at the service. There was three services during the week. So there was a service of reception for the remains of Richard III on the Sunday the 22nd, to which I did have an invite, and that was lovely, absolutely beautiful. And then on the Thursday, the reinterment service, which was inevitably a hot ticket, So although I was present, I was here in a like a volunteer capacity and marshalling my volunteers to help outside with the kind of the public face of things. Saw lots of guests arriving, including people like Benedict Cumberbatch, so that was quite a thrill. But it was all a bit kind of, we were on the outside looking in, and at a certain point, myself and my volunteers were standing in the Guild Hall, where there's a lot of press in the area and all of that, so some interesting conversations that went on. And then immediately after the service, when the guests had left, myself and a few volunteers were allowed to come into the cathedral on that side, just basically to have a look at the tomb in situ, the actual coffin in situ, yeah. Because it's underground, and at that point the tomb wasn't in place. So just to be there, just from a little distance, just to look down to see that was quite a special moment.
That's really special, isn't it?
Yeah.
And is, you've raised the question, so in my mind, is Richard in a vault? Or is he just dug into the ground?
He's in a vault. So it's a brick-lined vault into which there is a simple lead-lined oak coffin deposited about 3 or 4 feet underground.
Okay.
And that's sealed, and then you've got the tomb on top of it.
Yeah. And of course, I remember seeing some of this coverage on the TV, and I remember his coffin coming through the streets and that a crown had been commissioned for it. And is that in the vault with him?
No, the crown is actually over at the visitor centre on loan there with the pall. The pall that was here covering the coffin of Richard III whilst he lay in repose for a 3-day period. And that's a different story, because there was immense public interest about that. So the crown that was commissioned was on top of the coffin with this specially commissioned pall and a Vulgate Bible, a 15th century Bible, which was written in Latin. Now, whilst we've been having the restoration going on, and the cathedral was closed for quite some time, and we're having the Heritage Centre built, that pall has been on loan to the visitor centre across the road. And it looks beautiful over there. They put it in a really nice spot and it attracts a lot of interest and all of that. But from our aspect, we're pleased to know that it's coming back to the cathedral and will take pride of place in the Heritage Centre when it opens later this year.
That's fantastic. I can't wait to see when that visitor centre, maybe we could just come back to that right at the end to make sure people can stay abreast of what's happening and where they can get that information. Now, I also remember there was quite a lot of controversy about the tomb above ground and whether it was going to be almost like Gothic in the style of, or very modern and simplistic, which is what we have today. Can you tell us a little bit more about the options that were on the table and why that particular tomb was chosen?
Well, it's important to acknowledge that the actual fabric advisory committee, it's a national body. They didn't actually want us to have a tomb. They wanted just a plaque inlaid into the floor. Something very unfussy, because, you know, when monarchs die now, and they're buried in St George's Chapel at Windsor, that's how it's done, isn't it? Have that kind of monument marking the, you know, where they are buried. Now, mindful of the fact that this was going to be a place where we wanted to attract visitors, it's important for there to be something here that visitors can focus on. But equally important, actually, that whatever we put there told the story of Richard III. So the design itself actually tells the autobiographical elements of the Richard III story. So it has the date of his birth, the year of his birth and the year of his death. Also, you've got the boars, the personal emblem of Richard III, his personal motto chosen at the age of 9. But there's also the coat of arms that acknowledges his kingship, which is very important. Now, the Richard III Society had a particular view about how the tomb would look, and they did want something that was probably medieval in tone and appearance, but it wouldn't have fitted in here, because this was a parish church for many centuries. It's a small building, very Victorian in character because there was a major restoration during the Victorian era in this building. So a lot of what you see around you is very Victorian. Now, if you decided to have put within the ambulatory something grand, ornate, with an effigy, it would have looked out of place. So they went for something that was very simple, contemporary looking, but ancient, because the stone is from the Carboniferous era, so between 350 million and 299 million years old, yeah. But also it's heavy with symbolism. So it's tilted at one end. From our vantage point here, you can probably see that it's tilted at this end. So you've got Richard's head at this end, and he's facing the east, which of course is the Christian tradition, isn't it? But beyond that, you've got a deeply embedded cross. So the cross is there as the Christian symbol. The depth of it reminds us that Richard was a man of deep faith, but also that he bore very deep wounds in battle. But there's something else playing alongside this, and that is the depth of the incision takes us to the limit of what the stone will bear before it breaks open. So we're talking about a tombstone that could break open. We're talking about a tombstone that is tilted at one end, but it also, and we can't see it from here, but when you get close, you can see it's cut away underneath. So it gives the appearance that it's hovering, that something's about to happen. What this really is about the hope of resurrection, a tombstone that might break open, basically. So although you look at it and you think this is very simple, it's very contemporary, it is underlying this, it is heavy with symbolism.
Do you think we could go down and have a look at it? Maybe
to.
You could just point out a few of these things.
Absolutely.
Directly. That'd be great. Do you want to lead the way, Rebecca?
Yeah.
Dear listeners, we're just walking, we've just walked down the nave and we're coming into the ambulatory, and right in front of us here is this tomb. I personally find it very striking, and I'm a real fan of actually those old Gothic tombs and effigies. People will know I'm a real lover of tombs, and when I heard it was going to be modern, I was, oh, I don't know about that. But when I came to see it, actually, I found it very striking and very moving. Mm. So who designed it?
Well, it would have been decided, the design of it, between the architect. So it's a man by the name of Josh McCosh, who belongs to a firm of architects down in London. So he was the chief designer, but it also, it was the chapter, the administrative body of the cathedral, that had some input into this. Now, I know at a certain point, because originally, I think with the original designs, they suggested there would be like a white rose kind of design underneath where the tomb was going to be. But the Fabric Commission of England didn't like that, so they thought it was too fussy, and I think they made the right decision, in actual fact. So there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing about it. Josh McCosh at a certain point had to go back and simplify the designs, and this was ultimately what was decided.
I think it's very impactful. There's something about even just the size of the wording of his name, it just is incredibly impactful. I'm surprised how much is conveyed in such simplicity, actually. And I'm really glad you've been here to point out these features, because a lot of that would have passed me by, and probably passes quite a lot of people by. What do you think about it, can I ask?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's beautiful. It's beautiful in its simplicity. And I like the fact that it's overlaid with a lot of symbolism. And, you know, it's just visually striking. The juxtaposition with the ancient stone, I think, is a beautiful touch. It is. And you know, when you describe to people that stone has been formed by, it's basically dead marine life, which is compacted together. And it just reminds you of the actual brilliance of nature, of how things evolved over time.
Yeah. I think it's amazing. And this kind of brings me to talk about the new visitor centre. I wonder if you're going to be telling more of that story in the visitor centre to people.
I think initially there's going to be a lot of focus on the archaeology. Now, in advance of the building of the Heritage Centre, the Old Song School, which was a feature on the front of the cathedral, that had to be demolished. And then the ground had to be prepared in order for the building work to commence. And during that process, you know, they started to find quite a lot of human remains and things and remnants of past times. So, an archaeological dig took place, and as a result of that, you know, there's going to be a lot of stories that can be told about Leicester in the past, and I think that is something that is going to feature certainly initially in the Heritage Centre. Having said that, the pool that I was talking about earlier, that is going to come back, and it's going to be part of the Heritage Centre. So yes, certainly there's something, you know, it's an aspect of the cathedral that's been missing for a time, so it'd be great to have that back and to be able to include that in the whole Richard III story.
And you said that's due to open later this year?
Yes, it is. Now, we're hoping by the end of October.
Okay.
We're hoping there won't be any slippage to that. It's been a long time coming, but in some senses, the time has passed rather quickly because we've had the reopening of the cathedral in November last year, and that's drew quite a number of visitors in, and we've got a programme of activities that's going on. And as I say, time does pass speedily. But looking forward to that very much so.
That's fantastic. And where can people find out more information about all the latest?
Well, basically on our website. So Leicester Cathedral has a website. There's lots of information on there, lots of information about the dig that took place a couple of years ago and the blogs that are coming out of that, but also about Leicester Cathedral Revealed, the actual project, the building project, which has there's been a lot of internal improvements as a result of that. It's not just about the Heritage Centre that we're expecting. There are things that we're enjoying now in this space. You know, the floor has been leveled off. It has, but we've got some underfloor heating, some beautiful stone flooring in here. Pendant lighting has improved things. You know, lots of improvements around the place, and it's a real pleasure to be on duty here and to work here.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much. That's really, really interesting, and I've learned so much about the tomb. So thank you, Rebecca.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
my friends. I hope you enjoyed our adventure in time commemorating the anniversary of the Battle of Bosworth. Before I go, I just wanted to say a huge thank you to the staff at the King Richard III Centre and at Leicester Cathedral and also the Heritage Centre at Bosworth for enabling this visit, and of course particularly to our three guides, Steve Bruce, Harry Marr and Rebecca Hale. Thank you so much. I'm sure you'll agree. They made fantastic hosts for us along the way. Don't forget that you can visit our show notes page to find out links, which will give you visitor information about how to see all these locations and visit them for yourself. And the link you will need for the show notes page is in the description associated with this podcast. Well, that is all for this month. I hope you'll join me next month for another episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling!